Chapter 18. Out of the Jaws of Defeat. Artemisia watched them as they became tiny figures, trudging up the bare granite, then dipping below and out of sight. For a moment, just before they disappeared, one of them had turned. She couldn't be sure which one, and for a moment, her heart hardened. He had not said a word on parting, not one word. She turned away from the sun and rock toward the confined metal interior of the ship. She felt alone, terribly alone. She had never felt so alone in her life. It was that, perhaps, that made her shiver. But it would have been an intolerable confession of weakness to admit that it wasn't simply the cold. She said peevishly, "Uncle Gil, why don't you close the ports? It's enough to freeze a person to death." The thermometer dial read +7 centigrade, with the ship's heaters on high.
"My dear Arta," said Gilbert mildly, "if you will persist in your ridiculous habit of wearing nothing but a little fog here and there, you must expect to be cold."
But he closed certain contacts, and with little clicks, the airlock slid shut. The ports sunk inward and molded themselves into the smooth, gleaming hull. As they did so, the thick glass polarized and became non-transparent. The lights of the ship went on, and the shadows disappeared. Artemisia sat down in the heavily padded pilot's seat and fingered the arms aimlessly. His hands had often rested there, and the slight warmth that flooded her as she thought that, she told herself, was only the result of the heaters making themselves felt decently now that the outer winds were excluded. The long minutes passed, and it became impossible to sit quietly. She might have gone with him. She corrected the rebellious thought instantly as it passed through her mind and changed the singular him to the plural them. She said, "Why do they have to set up a radio transmitter anyway, Uncle Gil?" He looked up from the visiplate, the controls of which he was fingering delicately, and said, "Huh?" "We've been trying to contact them from out in space," she said, "and we haven't reached anyone. What special good would a transmitter on the planet's surface do?" Gilbert was troubled.
"Why, we must keep trying, my dear. We must find the rebellion world."
And between his teeth he added to himself,
"We must."
A moment passed, and he said,
"I can't find them."
"Find whom?"
"Byron and the Autarch. The ridge cuts me off no matter how I arrange the external mirrors. See?"
She saw nothing but the sunny rock flashing past. Then Gilbert brought the little gears to rest and said,
"Anyway, that's the Autarch ship."
Artemisia accorded it the briefest of glances. It lay deeper in the valley, perhaps a mile away. It glistened unbearably in the sun. It seemed to her at the moment to be the real enemy. It was, not the Tirani. She wished, suddenly, sharply, and very strongly, that they had never gone to Lingain, that they had remained in space, the three of them only. Those had been funny days, so uncomfortable and yet so warm, somehow. And now she could only try to hurt him. Something made her hurt him, though she would have liked. Gilbert said,
"Now what does he want?"
Artemisia looked at him, seeing him through a watery mist, so that she had to blink rapidly to put him into normal focus.
"Who? Rizzet?"
"I think that's Rizzet."
"But he's certainly not coming this way."
Artemisia was at the visiplate.
"Make it larger," she ordered.
"At this short distance," objected Gilbert, "you won't see anything. It will be impossible to keep it centered."
"Larger, Uncle Gil."
Muttering, he threw in the telescopic attachment and searched the bloated nubbles of rock that resulted. They jumped faster than the eye could follow with the lightest touch on the controls. For one moment, Rizzet, a large hazy figure, flashed past, and in that moment his identity was unmistakable. Gilbert backtracked wildly, caught him again, hung on for a moment, and Artemisia said,
"He's armed. Did you see that?"
"No."
"He's got a long-range blasting rifle, I tell you." She was up, tearing away at the locker.
"Arta, what are you doing?"
She was unzipping the lining from another spacesuit. "I'm going out there. Rizzet's following them. Don't you understand? The Autarch hasn't gone out to set up a radio. It's a trap for Byron." She was gasping as she forced herself into the thick, coarse lining.
"Stop it! You're imagining things!"
But she was staring at Gilbert without seeing him, her face pinched and white. She should have seen it before, the way Rizzet had been coddling that fool, that emotional fool. Rizzet had praised his father, told him what a great man the rancher of Widdemost had been, and Byron had melted immediately. His every action was dictated by the thought of his father. How could a man let himself be so ruled by monomania? She said, "I don't know what controls the airlock. Open it."
"Arta, you're not leaving the ship. You don't know where they are."
"I'll find them. Open the airlock." Gilbert shook his head. But the spacesuit she had stripped had borne a holster. She said, "Uncle Gil, I'll use this. I swear I will." And Gilbert found himself staring at the wicked muzzle of a neuronic whip. He forced a smile.
"Don't now."
"Open the lock," she gasped. He did, and she went out, running into the wind, slipping across the rocks and up the ridge. The blood pounded in her ears. She had been as bad as he, dangling the autark before him for no purpose other than her silly pride. It seemed silly now, and the autark's personality sharpened in her mind. A man so studdedly cold as to be bloodless and tasteless. She quivered with repulsion. She had topped the ridge, and there was nothing ahead of her. Stolidly, she walked onward, holding the neuronic whip before her. Byron and the autark had not exchanged a word during their walk, and now they came to a halt where the ground leveled off. The rock was fissured by the action of sun and wind through the millennia. Ahead of them, there was an ancient fault, the farther lip of which had crumbled downward, leaving a sheer precipice of 100 feet. Byron approached cautiously and looked over it. It slanted outward past the drop, the ground riddled with craggy boulders which, with time and infrequent rains, had scattered out as far as he could see. "It looks," he said, "like a hopeless world, Jaunty." The autark displayed none of Byron's curiosity in his surroundings. He did not approach the drop. He said, "This is the place we found before the landing. It's ideal for our purposes." "It's ideal for your purposes, at least," thought Byron. He stepped away from the edge and sat down. He listened to the tiny hiss from his carbon dioxide cylinder and waited a moment. Then he said very quietly, "What will you tell them when you get back to your ship, Jaunty? Or shall I guess?" The autark paused in the act of opening the two-handled suitcase they had carried. He straightened and said, "What are you talking about?" Byron felt the wind numb his face and rubbed his nose with his gloved hand. Yet he unbuttoned the foamite lining that wrapped him so that it flapped wide as the gusts hit it. He said, "I'm talking about your purpose in coming here. I would like to set up the radio rather than waste my time discussing the matter, Farrell." "You won't set up a radio. Why should you? We tried reaching them from space without a response. There's no reason to expect more of a transmitter on the surface. It's not a question of ionized radio opaque layers in the upper atmosphere either, because we tried the sub-ether as well and drew a blank. Nor are we particularly the radio experts in our party, so why did you really come up here, Jaunty?" The autark sat down opposite Byron. A hand patted the suitcase idly. "If you are troubled by these doubts, why did you come?"
"To discover the truth.
Your man, Rizzet, told me you were planning this trip, and advised me to join you. I believe that your instructions to him were to tell me that by joining you I might make certain you received no messages that I remained unaware of. It was a reasonable point, except that I don't think you will receive any message. But I allowed it to persuade me, and I've come with you."
"To discover truth?" said Jaunty mockingly.
"Exactly that. I can guess truth already."
"Tell me then. Let me discover truth as well."
"You came to kill me. I'm here alone with you, and there is a cliff before us over which it would be certain death to fall. There would be no signs of deliberate violence. There would be no blasted limbs or any thought of weapon play. It would make a nice, sad story to take back to your ship. I had slipped and fallen. You might bring back a party to gather me up and give me a decent burial. It would all be very touching, and I would be out of your way.
You believe this?
And yet you came. I expect it, so you won't catch me by surprise. We are unarmed, and I doubt that you could force me over by muscular power alone. For a moment, Byron's nostrils flared. He had half flexed his right arm, slowly and hungrily. But Jaunty laughed.
Shall we concern ourselves with our radio transmitter then, since your death is now impossible?
Not yet. I'm not done. I want your admission that you were going to try to kill me.
Oh. Do you insist that I play my proper role in this impromptu drama that you have developed? How do you expect me to force you to do so? Do you intend to beat a confession out of me? Now understand, Farrell, you are a young man, and I am disposed to make allowances because of that and because of the convenience of your name and rank. However, I must admit you have until now been more trouble than help to me.
So I have been, by keeping alive despite you.
If you refer to the risks you ran on Rhodia, I have explained it. I will not explain it again.
Byron rose. Your explanation was not accurate. It has a flaw in it which was obvious from the beginning.
Really?
Really. Stand up and listen to me, or I'll drag you to your feet. The autarch's eyes narrowed to slits as he rose.
I would not advise you to attempt violence, youngster.
Listen.
Byron's voice was loud, and his cloak still bellied open in the breeze, disregarded.
You said that you sent me to a possible death on Rhodia, only to implicate the director in an anti-Tyranian plot.
That remains true.
That remains a lie. Your prime object was to have me killed. You informed the captain of the Rhodian ship of my identity at the very beginning. You had no real reason for believing that I would ever be allowed to reach Henrik.
If I had wanted to kill you, Farrell, I might have planted a real radiation bomb in your room.
It would have been obviously more convenient to have the Tirani maneuvered into doing the killing for you.
I might have killed you in space when I first boarded the Remorseless.
So you might. You came equipped with a blaster and you had it leveled at me at one point. You had expected me on board, but you hadn't told your crew that. When Rizzet called and saw me, it was no longer possible to blast me.
You made a mistake then.
You told me you had told your men I was probably on board, and a while later, Rizzet told me you had not. Don't you brief your men concerning your exact lies as you tell them, Jaunty?
Jaunty's face had been white in the cold, but it seemed to whiten further.
I should kill you now for giving me the lie, certainly. But what held back my trigger finger before Rizzet got on the visiplate and saw you?
Politics, Jaunty. Artemisia Arth Henriad was aboard, and for the moment she was a more important object than myself. I'll give you credit for a quick change of plans. To have killed me in her presence would have ruined a bigger game.
I had fallen in love so rapidly then?
Love. When the girl concerned is a Henriad, why not? You lost no time. You tried first to have her transferred to your ship, and when that failed, you told me that Henrik had betrayed my father.
He was silent for a moment, then said,
So I lost her, and left you the field undisputed. Now, I presume, she's no longer a factor. She is firmly on your side, and you may proceed with your plan to kill me without any fear that by doing it you may lose your chance at the Henriad succession.
Jaunty sighed and said, Farrell, it is cold
and getting colder. I believe the sun is heading downward.
You are unutterably foolish, and you weary me.
Before we end this farrago of nonsense, will you tell me why I should be in the least interested in killing you anyway? That is, if your obvious paranoia needs any reason.
There is the same reason that caused you to kill my father.
What?
Did you think I believed you for an instant when you said Henrik had been the traitor? He might have been, were it not for the fact that his reputation as a wretched weakling is so well established. Do you suppose that my father was a complete fool? Could he possibly have mistaken Henrik for anything but what he was? If he had not known his reputation, would not 5 minutes in his presence have revealed him completely as a hopeless puppet? Would my father have blabbed foolishly to Henrik anything that might have been used to support a charge of treason against him? No, Jaunty. The man who betrayed my father must have been one who was trusted by him.
Jaunty took a step backward and kicked the suitcase aside.
He poised himself to withstand a charge and said, "I see your vile implication. My only explanation for it is that you are criminally insane." Byron was trembling, and not with cold. "My father was popular with your men, Jaunty. Too popular. An autarch cannot allow a competitor in the business of ruling. You saw to it that he did not remain a competitor. And it was your next job to see to it that I did not remain alive, either to replace or to avenge him." His voice raised to a shout which whipped away on the cold air. "Isn't this true?"
"No." Jaunty bent to the suitcase. "I can prove you are wrong." He flung it open. "Radio equipment. Inspect it. Take a good look at it."
He tossed the items to the ground at Byron's feet.
Byron stared at them.
"How does that prove anything?"
Jaunty rose. "It doesn't. But now, take a good look at this."
He had a blaster in his hand, and his knuckles were white with tension. The coolness had left his voice. He said,
"I am tired of you, but I won't have to be tired much longer."
Byron said tonelessly, "You hid a blaster in the suitcase with the equipment?"
"Did you think I wouldn't? You honestly came here expecting to be thrown off a cliff, and you thought I would try to do it with my hands, as though I was a stevedore or a coal miner. I am Autark of Lingain."
His face worked, and his left hand made a flat cutting gesture before him.
"And I am tired of the cant and fatuous idealism of the ranchers of Widdemose."
He whispered then, "Move on, toward the cliff." He stepped forward. Byron, hands raised, eyes on the blaster, stepped back.
"You killed my father, then."
"I killed your father," said the autarch.
"I tell you this so you may know in the last few moments of your life that the same man who saw to it that your father was blasted to bits in a disintegration chamber will see to it that you will follow him and keep the Henriad girl for himself thereafter, along with all that goes with her. Think of that. I will give you an extra minute to think of that.
But keep your hands steady, or I will blast you and risk any questions my men may care to ask." It was as though his cold veneer, having cracked, left nothing but a burning passion exposed.
"You tried to kill me before this, as I said."
"I did."
"Your guesses were in every way correct. Does that help you now?"
"Back."
"No," said Byron. He brought his hands down and said, "If you're going to shoot, do so."
The autarch said, "You think I will not dare?
I've asked you to shoot."
"And I will."
The autarch aimed deliberately at Byron's head, and at a distance of 4 feet, closed contact on his blaster.